Tonight on the Daily Debrief, the 448-page Mueller report is out.
The special counsel found no collusion.
Has the summary been accurate? We break down the findings. Also, an alternate suspect in the murder of a family of four. Was he really in Hawaii like he claims? Or is the man on trial the real killer? And a sad end to the search for a Colorado fiancé feared dead. This is the Daily Debrief. It's Thursday, April 18th.
And good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Daily Debrief. I'm Aaron Keller. The report of Special Counsel Robert Mueller is in, and in studio are former prosecutors Bob Bianchi and Ron Blitzer, framing criminal defense attorney Mike Korobanics. They are with me tonight to discuss it. Also with me tonight from Atlanta, Georgia, is Judge Ashley Wilcott. But first, Chief Investigative Correspondent Brian Ross is in our newsroom tonight with the core findings of the report. Brian, good to see you.
Well, good evening, Aaron. Here it is. 448 pages of the Mueller report. Some, but not a huge amount, redacted, mostly because it involves ongoing investigations of other people in the Trump world. There were a number of surprises in here, but for the most part, this is a completely comprehensive report of all we've heard over the years about allegations inside the Trump White House. The so-called fake news actually validated in large part by what Robert Mueller and his team found. This is a tough team that went hard against Trump and his people. And Trump, of course, found this to be very helpful. He criticized them during the time that the investigation was underway. But in fact, it works out better for him that this tough group of prosecutors, real killers, decided in the end they didn't have enough to bring a case against him.
Brian, a lot of information in this report to digest. Any big surprises from your perspective?
The surprise here, I think, for the most part, and what we're hearing talked about, is the initial sort of description of this event by Attorney General William Barr. It doesn't really hold up based on a reading of this. Now, we're still going through a lot of this, but a lot of the indications of Trump's involvement with Michael Cohen, whether he lied about the so-called Trump Tower project in Moscow. It's all laid out here in excruciating detail.
Brian Ross in our newsroom tonight. Appreciate that update for you, Brian. We're going to bring this out and widen out the discussion now with our full panel. Brian, I know you're going to stick around for that, but also in-house here, Ron Blitzer. He's here. Ron, you've been covering this from the beginning. You're a former prosecutor. Your takeaways.
I thought that this report was extremely eye-opening in terms of the details of the acts that Trump is said to have committed. However, it's important to focus on the other element in these crimes, particularly when it comes to obstruction, is the intent. You need the act and the intent. And the report clearly outlines acts regarding Trump's, at least, attempts to get Robert Mueller himself out of the way, trying to get him fired or at least to have the investigation limited in scope to avoid investigating his campaign. But when you look at the intent, to me, it looks like he really believed that people were out to get him and that because there was no collusion with Russia, that this investigation was unfounded, and that's why he wanted it all to go away. Now, whether you think that he was correct for thinking that is, you know, that's open to interpretation. But if that's what he believed, then I don't think he had the requisite intent to satisfy the elements of the crimes.
All right, I know Brian Ross was working on a report about this earlier today. We have that ready for you now. Let's go to that.
The president was quick to gloat about what he claimed was complete vindication.
No collusion, no obstruction.
And the president took to Twitter with this Game of Thrones-inspired tweet. No collusion, no obstruction. For the haters and the radical liberal Democrats, game over. But a close reading of the Mueller report suggests the game is hardly over. On the question of obstruction, Mueller wrote, if we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state. Based on the facts and the applicable legal standards, we are unable to reach that judgment. Yet Trump's Attorney General, William Barr, again today tried to leave the public with a much different impression.
The Deputy Attorney General and I concluded that the evidence developed by the special counsel is not sufficient to establish that the president committed an obstruction of justice offense.
The Mueller report lays out the facts of what it says were 10 instances where the president may have obstructed justice, including whether his public offers of support for General Michael Flynn, Paul Manafort, and Michael Cohen were designed to get them to keep quiet and not make plea deals with the special counsel. The report details Trump's fears of the special counsel. He told advisors that it was the end of his presidency, sought to have Attorney General Jefferson Jeff Sessions unrecuse from the Russia investigation, and to have the special counsel removed, and engaged in efforts to curtail the special counsel's investigation and prevent the disclosure of evidence to it, including through public and private contacts with potential witnesses. In fact, according to the report, when Trump learned of Mueller's appointment as special counsel, he told Attorney General Sessions, quote, "I'm f***ed. How could you let this happen, Jeff?"
That reporting there from Brian Ross really giving a fuller picture of what was in the Mueller report. Former prosecutor Bob Bianchi seated just to my left here. Bob, your takeaways on this.
Well, I think that the 10, let's start with how he constructs the report. The first thing is no collusion, very definitive statement by prosecutors that they did not believe that there was any evidence whatsoever that they could prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt. Let's not forget what we're dealing with here. That's the criminal law standard, and it's very hard. Doesn't mean that's truthful, but from their standpoint, they couldn't do it. But they're much more malleable, and to Ron's point a little bit about the obstruction, they give 10 areas, and they said if we could exonerate him, we would, but we can't. Keep in mind, too, Aaron, that there's Article II powers that the president has, as well as a DOJ memo that says they cannot indict a sitting president. And it would be unfair to say Donald Trump committed obstruction crimes, but provide him no avenue or recourse legally with which he can defend himself. So what I think they basically did is they said, here are the 10 areas that we see. Any one or combination of them could be obstruction. It's Congress's responsibility to make a decision as to what they want to do with it.
Okay, so this kicks it to Congress. Mike Korobanix, what are we talking about then?
Well, then you're talking about, I think, probably one of the longest hearings you'll ever see. Just you actually have, Bob, we're used to trying cases with maybe a 5-10 page police report. Yeah. Basically, you're talking about a 500, this is like the War and Peace of police reports, an investigation. And I think, first of all, just the organization of how to address questioning and things of that nature before Congress would be mind-boggling. I mean, you talk about going into uncharted, stormy waters. This is it.
Judge Ashley Wilcott is still on the line from Atlanta, Georgia here. We don't want to forget about her. Judge Wilcott, good to see you this evening. I know that everybody's digesting this report. It is important for people to get in the weeds and read this because, look, even if prosecutors are saying we're not going to charge him, there's things in here that are going to inform the minds of voters. So perhaps you could speak to that.
Yeah, absolutely. So it is, I'm still digesting it. It does give, as Ron said, a lot of detail, Aaron. And if you look at that detail, you see a lot about the actions of the president, the behavior of the president. Now, what's interesting to me is that Mueller really took a middle-of-the-road approach. It doesn't exonerate, and it does not give enough evidence to charge him with criminal acts. And then we all know that the attorney general said, William Barr said, well, wait, I'm going to read this as there's not sufficient evidence. Here's what it's going to do. It is going to cause multiple hearings, I think, on Capitol Hill. There's going to be a lot of testimony, and the public needs to be educated about exactly how this report reads to follow what happens on Capitol Hill.
Okay, everybody jump in on this. Ron Blitzer, I'm going to throw this your way, though. There were a lot of things in this report where they got really, really close, but no cigar on charges.
Yeah, there were some very close calls here, you know, talking about the 10 different episodes of possible obstruction. And with some of them, they definitely seemed to get really close to that, particularly when they discussed how Trump apparently asked Corey Lewandowski, his senior advisor at the time, to speak to Jeff Sessions, who was recused from the investigation, to give a message to Sessions to get involved and to talk to Mueller and restrict the scope of the investigation so that it would only focus on future election interference and nothing in the past, which would directly impede an ongoing investigation, which, if there was the requisite intent, would absolutely be obstruction of justice. It's just a question of what was Trump's intent.
Bob, do you agree?
Yes, and I think that what we know is that Barr's memo that he auditioned to get a job was refuted by their team. And what we got to deal with here is we have to understand what happened. We had an independent investigation. It was allowed to go on. They made findings. They could not proceed in the criminal context, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there wasn't truth to the obstruction. They did their job. Most of it was released to the public, and that's a good day for America, whether you're a Trump fan or not.
Judge Wilcott, your perspective on this as well.
Well, the same thing. I think that it's good that all this information came out. But, Aaron, all it does, too, is raise more questions because of the details. It's going to spawn more investigations. And, again, it's going to spawn hearings on Capitol Hill. But I agree with Bob completely. That's a good thing. All this information needs to come out and be investigated. This is not dispositive of the issue, but it's a good step in the right direction.
Look, the redactions here were very, very minor. I'm reading through this report. Everybody here is chewing on various sections of it. I hope those of you who are watching are going to take your time to read through it as well. We're going to move along, though. Still ahead tonight on The Debrief. Police give an unfortunate update in the search for a Colorado mother who they think was murdered by her fiancé. Plus, we take you back inside a California courtroom where a man is on trial for killing a family of four. Bank account records cast doubt on the alibi of an alternate suspect. More details after this. Colorado authorities have announced they will stop searching a landfill for the remains of a mom who is thought to have been murdered by her fiancé. Police say Kelsey Barrett was killed by her fiancé, Patrick Frazee, who is accused of bludgeoning her to death with a baseball bat and then setting her body on fire. Police have been searching a landfill in Fountain, Colorado for the past 2 months trying to find Barrett's charred remains. They say they did not find any bones, teeth, or DNA. Frazee has not entered a plea, but he will late next month. We are back in court tonight for the case of the California man accused of murdering a family of four. This case has been going on for months, and the defense is very close to resting. Here's a look at some of the key moments.
How does this family of four disappear off the face of the earth?
California small business owner Joseph McStay and his entire family disappeared February 4th, 2010. Their car was abandoned near the border. Authorities believed this video showed them fleeing to Mexico, presumably to avoid business debts. Case closed? Not even close. Fast forward more than 3 years to November 2013. A biker discovered the skull of one of the family members in the Mojave Desert.
I was traveling on a dirt road. I stumbled across the remains.
All four were buried nearby. Authorities arrested Chase Merritt, a business associate to Joseph McStay. They believe he killed for money.
The why boils down to greed and greed's child, fraud.
The defense says Merritt didn't do it.
Charles Merritt, which everybody calls Chase, that was his best friend.
The state has presented a $4,000 check from McStay to Merritt, made out the day McStay disappeared. But Merritt never cashed it. He told police there was always money and merchandise moving back and forth between him and McStay, since they frequently did business together.
Someone calls you and indicates that they are Joseph McStay.
Someone with at least some access to McStay's business accounts tried to change his QuickBooks software right after McStay vanished. The state also presented cell phone searches for information about the family's disappearance, made by Merritt, shortly after the family's bodies turned up in the desert. In those graves, a hammer prosecutors believe was the murder weapon. Also, shards of a bath mat. Authorities think it matches linens missing from the family's home.
They were beaten about the head and face until they died.
The family's home, prosecutors say, is the crime scene, but evidence is scant.
You will look for things of signs of violence, correct?
Yes.
And you didn't see any of them?
No, sir.
One officer who took photographs there realized back at the lab that she may have found blood on the family's table, but she didn't see it when she was in the house, and it was cleaned before anyone knew it was there.
When I saw it, I was horrified.
Why?
Because I thought it was something I missed.
The defense is pointing to an alternate suspect who also did business with the family, and to unknown DNA found in the family's graves.
Defense tests on two items found buried in those graves revealed the DNA profiles of three unknown people. The unknown profiles came from a rope tied around Joseph McStay's neck and from Summer McStay's bra, which was cut, presumably by her attacker or attackers. The unknown profiles are from none of the McStays and are not from defendant Chase Merritt. Who were they from, and why did the police not perform good enough tests to discover this evidence themselves? Do the DNA profiles, rather, recovered from those items contain the identities of the true killers? The defense is asking many of these questions. The defense in this case has named another possible suspect whom they say the police failed to fully investigate and who they say could be the real killer. His name is Dan Kavanaugh, and he also did business with victim Joseph McStay. Kavanaugh's PayPal account number was used by someone in Hawaii around the time of the murders. But last night, a witness testified that the actual account was being accessed in California the time the McStays disappeared from there.
These are Dan Kavanaugh's PayPal records. We show January 14th, and you indicated 12:13 a.m. Is that IP address associated with a region?
Yes.
And what is that?
That IP address is associated with Hawaii.
Okay. And we have, it looks like there's three entries, all on January 14th, the last being at 12:31?
12:31 a.m.
Okay. With the same IP address, so that also would be Hawaii, correct?
That's right.
All right. What about the next entry, which it looks like there's a 12-day gap?
That's right. January 26th is the next entry.
So January 26th, the time is 4:47?
4:47 a.m.
Okay, and now we have a new address, 70.95.69.75. What area is that IP address associated with?
The San Diego area.
And then a new IP address starts in on February 18th, is that correct?
February 17th, actually.
I'm sorry, February 17th. And is that a 208.54.4.52?
Yes, it is.
Did you check the geographic region of that?
Yes, I did.
And what geographic region is that associated with?
That region is associated with Southern California in general. That is a T-Mobile address, so that is a mobile device, and often those regions are not as specific as some of the other ones.
The key is that alternate suspect Dan Kavanaugh's account was being accessed from Southern California, where the murders happened, at the time the murders happened. It was last accessed in Hawaii more than a week before the family is believed to have been killed.
Would it be safe to say that over 90% of the rest of the geographic regions associated with Dan Kavanaugh's PayPal records are either San Diego area or Southern California area?
Absolutely. The vast majority of many different IP addresses is the Southern California or specifically San Diego area.
Did you see any geographic region associated with Hawaii after that first January 14th date?
No, I did not.
Yesterday in court, testimony centered yet again on financial records. The defense is trying to counteract the prosecution's claim that money, greed, cost four people their lives.
Does the zero number there correspond to Chase being paid what he's owed according to this spreadsheet?
Objection calls for speculation and hearsay.
This column, so the zero is the sum of the balance column that we were looking at before. We already established that the balance was the what was identified as dollars to Chase, subtracting the payments listed in there. So again, if the payments equal the amount owed to Chase, that was zero, and the grand total sum of this is zero. So yes, this is a showing that at the end of the day, Joseph and Chase were squared away. And I do know that Joseph is the author of this document, as well as the last author.
So that document indicates that they were zeroing out, that there was not money owed back and forth between the victim and this particular defendant. When law enforcement officers interrogated defendant Chase Merritt, they told him that they plotted his phone using GPS precision right to the location where the McStays were buried. Did authorities, though, have accurate information? The defense says no, they did not, and that the confusion led the authorities to chase the wrong man.
In your case summary, you indicated that on February 4th, Mr. Merritt was in Fallbrook, right? And he had turned off his cell phone as to not be, so he could evade his location.
That was my belief, yes.
Okay. And then on February 6th, so in other words, you were saying that while he's killing the family on February 4th, he turns off his phone so that his location won't be known, correct?
I don't know that he turned it off at the time he was killing the family, but I believe it was turned off before the murders happened, yes.
And then 2 days later, when he's burying the bodies, he turns it on and makes a series of phone calls to his wife and daughter. Is that correct?
Assumes facts, not evidence, and is argumentative.
And you wrote that in your summary, that he turned, that his phone was on during the time that he's burying the bodies in the desert, correct?
I believe that what it...
Same objection.
Let's bring the panel into this one. Mike, Bob, Ashley, let me start with you, Judge Wilcott. What's going on with these bank records that suggest that Kavanaugh, the alternate suspect, was accessing his account from California when these deaths actually happened?
Right. So what's going on is reasonable doubt, Aaron. This is such a circumstantial case. That is the suspect, as you pointed out, that is the alternative suspect that defense is saying he did it. When he's accessing that information and accessing that money, greed could be the same motive for him. So I think it equals reasonable doubt.
Okay. I think this is a pretty solid defense case. I'll characterize it that way. And Bob, Mike, the defense is doing the DNA testing here and coming up with these three unknown profiles. This looks like sloppy police work, and it looks like the defense having to carry a burden here. Mike.
Well, I know this would have never happened when he was the head prosecutor in Morris County, but it really is really unusual that you have defense doing tests and carrying the ball.
Yeah, defense doesn't do tests unless they know from their client to an absolute certainty that those tests are not going to come out against them. Aaron, I've said this about this case. I've tried a lot, and so has Mike, of difficult murder cases as a prosecutor, but I believed every one of them to be guilty. The proofs were just difficult. In this case, I've said from the beginning, I have to have suspicions as to whether or not they charge the real perpetrator.
This is a really tough case. And look, I need Judge Wilcott, I think you agree on this. We've got a great panel put together on this. It's a tough one, and we're going to be watching it very closely. So, Judge Wilcott, we appreciate you being on the debrief. Mike, Bob, you as well. And, of course, thanks for those of you watching along with us. You can join us tomorrow at 5 o'clock Eastern for this recap of Legal News Nationwide. Our live trial coverage itself begins at 9 a.m. We'll see you then.